Ready to optimize your nutrition this year? Factor has chef-made gourmet meals that make eating well easy. They're dietitian approved and ready to heat and eat in 2 minutes. So you can feel right and feel great, no matter what life throws at you. Factor arrives fresh and fully prepared, perfect for any active, busy lifestyle. Lose up to 8 pounds in 8 weeks with Factor Keto meals. Based on a randomized, controlled clinical trial with Factor Keto, results will vary depending on diet and exercise. With 40 options across 8 dietary preferences on the menu each week, it's easy to pick meals tailored to your goals. Choose from preferences like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, or Keto. Factor can help you feel your best all day long with wholesome smoothies, breakfasts, grab-and-go snacks, and more add-ons. Reach your goals this year with ingredients you can trust and convenience that can't be beat. Eat smart with Factor. Get started at factormeals.com/factorpodcast and use code FACTORPODCAST to get 50% off your first box plus free shipping. That's code FACTORPODCAST at factormeals.com/factorpodcast to get 50% off plus free shipping on your first box.
With HelloFresh, you get farm-fresh, pre-proportioned ingredients and seasonal recipes delivered right to your doorstep. Skip trips to the grocery store and count on HelloFresh to make home cooking easy, fun, and affordable. That's why it's America's number one meal kit. It's easy to find time to eat well with 50 wholesome, hassle-free meals to choose from each week delivered to your door. Their lineup of prep and bake meals come together with minimal mess and only 5 minutes of prep, so your oven does most of the work, not you. Get up to 10 free meals and a free high-protein item for life at HelloFresh.com/HelloFreshPodcast. One item per box with active subscription. Free meals applied as discount on first box. New subscribers only. Varies by plan. That's up to 10 free HelloFresh meals. Just go to HelloFresh.com/HelloFreshPodcast. HelloFresh, America's number one meal kit.
So the curtain falls on an eventful 2024 for Norwich City with an eventful 1-1 draw against QPR at Carrow Road this afternoon. Welcome to this week's edition of the Pinkin.com Norwich City podcast. I'm your host, Connor Southwell, joined by Paddy Davitt and Adam Harvey. And of course, this podcast is brought to you in association with First Bus. And sadly, we're going to be spending a lot of it again talking about FA processes, which I've learned far too much about in the last few weeks than I ever wanted to. But there we go. And that probably feels like the place to start, Paddy, as we delve into the events of a fraught, frenetic, frustrating afternoon at Carrow Road. Let's start with Borja Sainz. FA probe at this stage. He's not been, and it's important we reiterate that, not been charged with anything. What can you tell us at this stage?
Well, yeah, let's caveat it. I mean, we're sat here now, we're 2 hours after the game, Sunday afternoon, so these things can move very quickly, or not, as the case may be with Angus Gunn and his situation, which was only resolved pertinent because, you know, today we've had QPR, and that incident relating to the QPR away game was only resolved really definitively Boxing Day with his clearance to play against Millwall after he accepted his misconduct charge and fine, wasn't he? £4,500, was it? But, and of course, Kenny McLean, who I'm looking down at on the table here, which works for our visual viewers rather than our audio listeners. But back today after his four-game retrospective FA ban related to an incident in that corresponding fixture. And we thought, that's in the rearview mirror, we don't need to worry about that again. And lo and behold, here we are awaiting, potentially, and there'll be a lot of potential and caveats and alleged caveats in this discussion, but could be a 6-game ban, because that is the FA tariff for the offence of spitting, and that is the alleged incident that the FA are looking into regarding Borja Sainz, regarding the Sunderland defender, I believe in the first half of that recent game in Wearside just before Christmas, the 2-1 defeat, which was quite a frenetic affair. You know, we were all there, and there was a few running skirmishes, I would say, with Sainz, one or two of the Sunderland players. I think even the Sunderland manager, yep, if I remember, Adam, yep, was talking about that in his post-match, about how he'd had a bit of an in coming together with Sainz. So a very fraught occasion, and alas, it would appear there's something there that the FA are right now looking at, and this is where we need to sort of just be very clear. No FA charges has been forthcoming yet towards Norwich and Borja Sainz, but they are looking at something which may lead to, and then if that is the case, then Norwich will obviously have to have their right of reply. Then it's, you know, gets into the realms of what the evidence is, you know, how categoric that evidence is, what form that evidence is. Is it electronic? Is it, you know, one version of an event against maybe a counter version, and who you decide is the accurate version? So, but all of that is clearly an unwanted distraction now, and we obviously had to ask Johannes direct after the game. At this stage, he could only confirm that the FA are looking into something. Clearly said there's no charge, wouldn't be able to be drawn on whether it was a spitting incident, an alleged spitting incident. But his sense was, maybe because he's now an expert as we are on these matters, that the next game being Wednesday, New Year's Day, Luton, that'll be too soon for this process to run its course. And for our science, if hypothetically it was an FA charge and a ban, it would be suspended for that. So I think he's planning at this stage for Borja to be involved in the Luton game. But he made the point, and it's a fair one, that, you know, clearly his focus today, yesterday, was all on this game, this QPR game. So he didn't really have an opportunity. He more or less intimated the FA had only really been in touch in the last day or two. So he's, I think, effectively parked it, focused on today. Now today's out of the way. I think he'll probably sit down with Borja, as will other club officials tomorrow, and then they will establish, from the Norwich perspective, from that player's perspective, what exactly has gone on in that game on Sunderland that the FA are looking at. And then from that, I'm sure in the next 24, 48 hours, the FA's position will become clear as well, in terms of whether they're following through in a process. And if that is the case, then potentially, you know, Norwich could be without Borja Sainz for most of January, which would be, you know, even for a player who's you know, we had quotes from Johannes leading into this game, has found out that maybe Championship teams, the Sunderland game being a pertinent example, are trying to stop him now with, by all means possible, fair means and foul. And he struggled a little bit, but still, to be without Borja Sainz in the Norwich lineup for the next period would be a crushing blow. So, but you know, we're probably running ahead of ourselves. The situation in the here and now is the FA have identified to Norwich there's something they're looking at in that first half at Sunderland, which we believe to be of an alleged spitting incident, and that's where we're at, and everything else will develop from there in the coming days.
Yes, and unless you gents have seen it, which I don't think you have, and I certainly haven't, it would be unfair, I think, on us to pass any judgment on Borja Sainz, on the process and the situation. We'll obviously have to wait for all of that to become clear. But it's another disciplinary footnote, Adam, in what's felt like pretty constant FA investigations into Norwich City for the last month or so. Now, we have spoken at length about the Kenny McLean one. We've spoken about the Angus Gunn one. Irrespective of maybe you feel they were right or if you feel they were wrong, it does bring up, I guess, a natural question about discipline, doesn't it? And where this group is. They had, I think prior to the Boxing Day game, I looked and they were second in the division behind Preston on yellow cards. And I think, it's not even necessarily relating to the Borja Sainz incident, but I think it probably provokes that conversation around discipline and where they're at with that, because it does feel like something that probably adds fuel to the fire on those who say they maybe have been of ill discipline this season.
Yeah, it's becoming a bit of a recurring theme now, seemingly, that Norwich's lack of discipline in games, and, you know, it's costing them not only within games, but also, you know, the knock-on effect of these retrospective bans, you know, that Johannes has said it a few times, that, you know, Kenny's been missing for, what, 30% of the games so far this season, and we know the impact that he can have. So to be missing him, all right, you can make the argument, you know, about kind of the first red card against Borough, you know, it's a silly challenge at that stage of the game, and what came after that in terms of the extra ban with the sort of language that I think a lot of people would have seen now that he used towards the fourth official. That's just silly and, you know, a bit naive, and I'm looking back at that, I think, you know, he knows himself that was a silly one. You can obviously debate the one against QPR and how stupid that was in terms of a charge and the retrospective ban that he got for it. But these yellow cards, whether it's just a naivety because it's still quite a young squad, and whether that's something that with time they'll realise that, you know, it needs to be cut out of their game a little bit, because it will cost them, as Cordoba found out at Sunderland. You know, it's just a stupid challenge to be making at that position in the pitch, and also that time of the game where Norwich was starting to come under a little bit of pressure from Sunderland. You don't want to be losing an extra body. Bang, they're 2-1, you know, and that really was game over at that point. I know they had the chance quite late on with Barnes, but yeah, it's costing them a lot, and it's got to be a bit of a concern that someone needs to get a hold of, because there's still a lot of experienced players in that group that will know how to navigate that. You know, the likes of Shane Duffy, Kenny McLean, you know, should be setting an example, but unfortunately at the moment that doesn't seem to be the case. And, you know, with this one with signs, we obviously can't really pass a comment on it yet, but if he has done the act that's been put against him, then what are you doing? You know, it's just shouldn't be in the game at all, and he will get punished, rightfully so, if that is the case. But fingers crossed, you know, that can be found wrongly, because Norwich don't want to be without another key man for another key period of the season, which, you know, just is becoming too much of a regular theme at the moment.
Yeah, and let's talk about the process a little bit, because I think in this sort of situation, when there's an investigation, you go back immediately to maybe past situations where a similar thing has happened, and it's happened in the Premier League, I think, towards the end of the 22-23 campaign, and Wolves' Daniel Podence, is that how you say it, Podence, was investigated on a similar claim against Brennan Johnson when he was at Nottingham Forest, and that was investigated thoroughly. And when there is such a high tariff, and we know, Paddy, if Borja Sainz is charged and he is found guilty of this, of what he's being alleged to have done, then it's a high tariff. It's a sick train ban. That's a huge amount of games to impose on anybody. So I guess this sort of makes the point that the evidence, which we haven't seen, I don't think Norwich City have maybe seen at this stage, has to be of a high threshold. It feels like that. And eventually with the Podence case, he was kind of cleared of any wrongdoing, because they couldn't definitively prove that he did spit at an opponent. So it's a difficult thing to prove, and that makes for quite a complex investigation. That's sort of the point I'm making.
Yeah, and as I say, we've kind of get to the hypotheticals of it at the moment. But I think that point from that case you cite previously, I think is the key one, that it would have to be. I mean, for a 6-game punishment to be attached, it would have to be definitive. You know, it couldn't simply, for me, be one version of events from one individual, and then a counter version of events, because then you're into the realms of who's the most believable kind of thing. You know, is there witnesses that can be called? So I think I would like to think that the FA, if we're going to follow through on a 6-game ban, hypothetically, that they have definitive evidence of a video nature, and that will come to light, I'm sure, in due course. But you know, it was included in the referee's report, so you can take it from that it was highlighted by a Sunderland player during the game. But beyond that, we don't know, you know, what subsequently, and from Norwich's point of view as well, you know, do they have video evidence they can bring to bear to counter that? But obviously a lot of the Norwich position, I guess, is TBC, because as to reiterate what I said in my opening comments, Torup hasn't sat down with science. I doubt whether the Ben Nappers and the people who matter at the club in these matters, they will have sat down with science, simply because we're in the midst of this festive programme of games and training. So until they do, until, you know, they get effectively Borja Sainz's version, then we don't know what Norwich's position will be, you know, and that's why it's probably at this stage more of a situation where we just have to say, put it out there where we are at the moment, and then leave it at that, because I think to sort of debate it too much without full recourse to what even Norwich's position is in this situation, let alone the evidence, is probably a bit of an academic exercise, really. But dealing in the facts of the matter are, yes, the FA are looking into an incident involving Borja Sainz in that Sunderland game, and it's of an alleged tariff that, or an alleged type of incident that carries a 6-game tariff. So, you know, the potential ramifications are far-reaching, really. You know, we thought 4 games for Kenny McLean was a bit on the steep side, but if you lost Borja Sainz for 6 games, it might add a renewed focus to what they're trying to do in January, in terms of a certain maybe Czech wide player. So, I don't at any point in this debate want to basically say it's a fait accompli and Borja Sainz is out for that length of time. But if that is going to be the case,
if it's proven, that's what it will be.
Yeah, if that is the case, purely in terms of, okay, he's not available, how did Norwich move forward? There's obviously, as I said, there's players they can bring in this window, soon to be opened window. But also, let's not forget Josh Sargent should be back in a matter of games, hopefully one or two games. So no way does that compensate for Borja Sainz being taken out for 6 games, given, you know, his productivity up to the last 4 or 5 games. But it does soften the blow somewhat. But again, we're getting to a point of this timescale that we haven't quite reached yet. So I guess we can deal with the fallout if there is fallout to deal with.
Yes, so very much watch this space over that one, and of course we'll bring you any updates when it drops from the FA or from Norwich City over the coming days. The expectation, as Paddy said at this stage, is that he will be available for that New Year's Day trip to Luton, which is swiftly coming into focus. And I think for the reasons we've discussed, given the complexity of maybe the investigation that needs to be conducted, that's going to be very, very hard to see how that could be wrapped up in such a short period of time that we've got between Sunday night as we sit here to Wednesday when Norwich play at Kenilworth Road. But, you know, as with the Kenny McLean incident, you can never completely rule it out. Let's look back on today's game then, Adam. Obviously, this is our first podcast since that Sunderland defeat, so we will speak a little bit about the Boxing Day win against Millwall as well, and we'll maybe tie them together slightly. But frustration, is that probably the overriding feeling today? Because even though Norwich City weren't at their best, we could be sat here talking about, and maybe should be sat here talking about, another 3 points.
Yeah, I think QPR didn't register a shot on target at all in the whole 101 minutes, whatever it was, in the end. So given that metric and that statistic, and, you know, Norwich are at home, and we know their relative strength at home and the sort of fortress nature they've managed to build there over the course of this calendar year as a whole, but also even stretching back kind of in the back end of 2023, they should be putting those sort of sides to bed. And I think there was almost that extra emphasis to try and get a kind of sense of revenge, I suppose, given the nature of the defeat at Loftus Road and how poor they were that day. And they were pretty passive in the first half, didn't really create that much in terms of openings, and obviously to concede the moment they did in the game was, you know, frustrating, and you could sense that within the crowd at half time. And, you know, you can argue about refereeing decisions and X, Y, and Z, but they weren't at the races really in the first half. Second half, they stepped up a little bit. For me, not quite the intensity and kind of that sort of free flowing football that we've seen in the early parts of the season, where, you know, I think they would have put QPR probably to 2 or 3, maybe even more, had it been kind of those performance levels we saw against Hull and Watford and, you know, et al. Back in kind of the early parts of the season. And they just never really sort of, you never really got that sense that was going to be the case today. Obviously, Nunez popping up probably to at least get them at a point that they richly deserved on the basis of play. But what frustrated me was kind of in the latter stage of the game, you know, they just got the equaliser. You think the momentum's now shifted completely onto your kind of, your front foot. You had the opportunity then to kick on, and they didn't really carve anything in those sort of 7 minutes of stoppage time to try and get the win, which I think they probably could have done on another day. So, yeah, just as you said, sort of at the outset there, frustration is kind of the overriding emotion. I kind of got that feeling, I suppose, from the reaction from the those fans that have stayed for kind of that whistle to blow.
Yeah, and it was a horrible game, Paddy, wasn't it? And it was stop-start. I mean, we had a farcical situation in the second half where we had a three-minute stoppage for, there was a player down, but also because QPR hadn't quite got a sub ready, and then we had to wait for them. Why we had to wait for them to get a sub ready to then bring on, I'm not quite sure, but that's how it unfolded. It was gritty. It never really felt like it got going, and that probably either team really, and it suited QPR more because at that stage they had a lead. But from a Norwich perspective, it never really felt like they got any sort of rhythm or flow to the game. And that in the first half was largely down to what QPR did off the ball. They were very effective. I think I've seen them 3 or 4 times under Cifuentes and always been very impressed by how well coached they are, how well organised they are. They always seem to cause Norwich City problems and really give them challenges. And I think they pressed Norwich in that first half as well as I've seen anyone do at Carrow Road this season. And in the second half, it was probably the reverse of that. They weren't pressing as much. There wasn't really any attacking intent, but they made the game horrible. And it was probably a management of the game that maybe Norwich City haven't done quite as effectively. And that all of that contributed probably to quite a, yeah, quite a bitty Norwich City display that probably lacked rhythm and flow.
Yeah, I thought it was a distinct lack of collectively in the energy that you need, which they kind of mustered against Millwall, certainly that first half against Millwall. Whether that's just the festive schedule that we're now into the real sort of back, well, kind of halfway just over, but into the back end of it, and it's quite a lot of those players going through this for the first time. Head coach has not experienced this kind of schedule before, and, you know, made one change today, didn't he, to his starting lineup, bringing back McLean. Could he have freshened up a little bit more? I just thought they looked a bit leggy. I mean, it was very passive. I mean, QPR were good in terms of their shape out of possession, but I think Norwich made it a bit easier for them. It was very lateral. There was no real penetrative movement.
Laboured, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I don't think Schwartau and Cernak and Sainz really worked as a trio. They didn't offer enough, really, in terms of those combinations or trying to get in behind or give those that QPR defence too much to think about. And as a result, you know, it was heading to a 0-0 until that dreaded defensive vulnerability on set pieces reared its head again, as it did at Loftus Road from another corner. And obviously, Yannis' post-match, I got the sense he's probably at the end of his tether with that now. That, you know, that was maybe the straw that broke the camel's back. How he responds, time will tell. But, you know, without too much prompting, he was very unhappy with, again, that latest concession. Because it, as he said, it completely changed his half-time team talk, the messaging he had to get across, you know, the sense of where they were going in that game. That they, I think they were generally in control of the game, albeit not offering too much end product. But from a decent platform, you'd like them then to feel they'd go on and step it up and then go on and get the win. And of course, then you're on the back foot. But to be fair, second half, I thought they did respond. Whether that was QPR dropped into a bit more preservation mode and tried to probe on the counter in transition. But I mean, I counted three or four free headers from Norwich players in the box in that second half, and not one of them was on target. That's just unacceptable, really. Is that in its own way, it's as poor as how they are defending set pieces now. You know, they needed to be testing the keeper at the very least. Shane Duffy had the best one, of course, and maybe a combination of keeper and bar. But just off it in terms of the energy levels and maybe just the decision making as well. You know, that chance that Sainz had where the keeper's inexplicably passed it to him along the 6-yard box. He's actually done the hard part for me and he's gone round the keeper. He's got Marcondes, he's got Hernandez unmarked, edge of the 6-yard box, and he's gone for the tightening angle and put it in the side netting. You know, just those, that sharpness of thought, sharpness of deed wasn't there today. And like you say, laboured is probably the best label to attach to that. So in that context, to actually dredge a draw out of it isn't the worst off the back of getting three against Millwall. You know, 4 points just keeps it ticking over and they can go to Luton and then Coventry back at Carrow Road and try and build on it. Because, you know, to walk off that pitch today and losing that game, I mean, Yannis actually used the word disaster. He said that would have been a disaster, probably for the point Adam makes, against the team who didn't have a recorded shot on target, didn't show a huge amount of ambition, and basically have profited from another set piece. So that's how he was thinking. I think it's safe for us to say that, yeah, that would have been a very poor way to see the end of 2024, particularly at Carrow Road, where both under, you know, Wagner and certainly now under Thorup, they have been, by and large, very good, very entertaining, good brand of football. I don't think they were anywhere near those heights today, but, you know, on the upside, they kept going and they dug out a result against, yeah, a pretty well-drilled QPR team, actually, who, let's not forget, were smarting from going to Swansea Boxing Day, being 3-0 down after about half an hour. They were always going to respond. There was always going to be a reaction. But still, you know, that's the type of game, really, and we all know where Norwich are trying to get to. That's the type of game you need to comfortably package in the 3 points move on category.
Yeah, which you know, and let's speak about those set pieces for a minute, Adam, because you think about what Norwich have done at home of late, and some of the games that they've had. We could probably, I think, chuck three into this category. So the Zian Fleming goal, obviously the second Burnley goal, the one that Romain Eze scored for Millwall, and today's one. So four goals we're talking about. I'm not sure any of them would really constitute a big chance, and that's the frustration. Probably, you know, that Zian Fleming one is a lack of concentration. The second one against Burnley, probably a lack of structure and maybe a lack of concentration as well, and a poor decision from Sainz on halfway. The Millwall one was, again, probably a catalogue of errors, but not one you would really describe as a fantastic opportunity. He's had a shot for a sea of bodies on the edge of the penalty area. And that probably, and then obviously today where QPR haven't registered a shot on target and have left with a point. So if you're Yannis off Turup, I think you're probably pulling your hair out a little bit, aren't you? Because it is about set pieces, but the quality of goals they're conceding generally has been pretty soft. I mean, he said post-match that since the first international break, 40% of their goals have been set pieces. And you look at it and in terms of coaching and open play, they're not doing a lot wrong in games. They should have more points than they have, but it's around the margins, and that is where probably the set pieces element comes into focus. And you know, I spoke to Ben Crisene after the game, and he almost felt it's a concentration point more than a structure point. What do you make of, again, it's something we've spoken about so liberally, but set pieces, again, they're Achilles heel. What do you make of it?
Yeah, it's frustrating because, you know, when you concede a goal due to individual quality or team collective quality, you know, you sit back and say, yep, you know, that's fair enough. You know, we've been or conceded a goal off the basis of something that's merited of a goal. When it's the kind of nature of goals like I've seen at the moment, so soft, and you're just giving yourself a mountain to climb so early on in games, or even when, you know, you've got the lead and you just need to retain control, don't lose your heads. And it seems like Norwich, you know, this sort of naivety and emotions that we've spoken around a lot in terms of recent performances just seem to be getting the better of them, and they switch off in key moments in games, and it's costing them big time because they've dropped far too many points from winning positions or even positions like today where, okay, you know, 0-0, you just need to see the game out till half time and then you can regroup, Torrent get his messaging across and you can go again in the second half. And just, yeah, such a soft goal to concede. And, you know, it's becoming a bit of a concerning theme, the kind of element of set pieces. You know, we've spoken there, Paddy mentioned it, about kind of the amount of free kicks they had today going in the box, free headers, and they're not capitalising on that yet. At the other end, they're conceding goals that, you know, in fact, they wouldn't score themselves from set pieces at the moment. So all round, it's there's something internally that needs to be looked at, and clearly Torrent's of that opinion as well. And if they can cheer that up, given the fine margins of a lot of the games recently, then I think they will start to flip the results and they'll be on the right side of those. But unfortunately, they're falling on the wrong side of it at the moment because just an incapability to control themselves in those situations. And yeah, hopefully then, moving forward into the second half of the season, the goals they can see will be more down to the individual quality I mentioned rather than soft goals. You know, this kind of soft underbelly that's been a theme now of this Norwich group for, what, a couple of years probably, really. Even under Wagner, you look at some of the goals they conceded. But I don't think it's kind of a it's more of a mentality and a set-up issue, clearly, from set pieces than it is kind of individual goals that they're conceding to due to quality. So hopefully they can get the better of that sooner rather than later.
Yeah, it undoes so much good work, Paddy, doesn't it? Because you think about that first half that they had at Sunderland, where Sunderland didn't have a shot on target. They limited Burnley to very little. And then, you know, at Sunderland, you can see 2 minutes, you know, after the break from a set piece, second phase, but still from a set piece situation. And you can see it against Burnley switching off. And okay, yes, what Ian Fleming does from 25, 30 yards is magic, but it doesn't help if you've got nobody who's awake to switch it. So for all of that hard work that they've got at the moment, that's going to be the most frustrating point from Torrent's perspective, because in open play, I don't think they look that bad defensively.
No, and I think that's the root of his, you know, I'd advise anybody just to, you know, jump on the Pinkton YouTube and watch today's post-match, and that section particularly, it felt almost, yeah, as I say, it looked like the dam had burst today in terms of how he was talking about that, and in those terms that, you know, they're doing so much good work. And they're doing the hard bits. They've got this structure in place now, the way they move the ball. There was plenty of evidence, albeit without the end product today, but some lovely, I thought Callum Dore was excellent in possession today. Nunes was his usual slick self, and Spencer Lomani looks so very at home now in that midfield, very clever and very happy to take the ball in tight situations. So there's so much about Hofball, to give it that label, that is very difficult to put in place, and they've kind of achieved that most weeks, not all the time, and not for the entirety of games. But so he must think, well, I've done the hard part here. You know, I've almost embedded now the identity of how I want my team to play, and yet they go out on the park and they can't defend the corner. They've got three or four Norwich shirts there, and that
it's all Norwich shirts in that section.
Yeah, I mean,
Jimmy
Dunn has made a movement to the near post, and that's brought Kenny McLean out. And there's a debate: is it come off Dunn? Is it come off McLean? But then it flies back, hits Sir Natch, and goes over. I mean, it's Parks football, concessions, QPR away. You know, the poorness of how they didn't defend the corner, and then that set piece from the free kick. The two in open play at Sunderland. Yeah, the Burnley one. It's just, these aren't isolated. This is a pattern now. This is a pattern of evidence building up against Torrent and this group of players and the coaching staff. It's not all on Nick Stanley, because we've had that debate, obviously, in recent times, but and routinely, they're not finding the answers. So something has to change. Something has to change. Otherwise, all that positive stuff around Hofball and its residual effectiveness, you know, an ability to go and play a Burnley and a Sunderland and before that Sheffield United and Leeds and top-end teams and not look out of place, counts for nothing. Because you walk off the park and you've drawn a game you should have won, or you've lost a game you should have drawn through your own defensive inability. For what's, for me, should be something from a coaching perspective, It's a very structured part of any game, isn't it? Set pieces, setting up, anticipating. There's so much evidence now, video evidence. You can do your homework on the opposition, what they're trying to do. Of course, they're always going to try and stay one step ahead and reinvent and bring new free kick and corner routines to the party. But there'll be fundamentals in any team's approach that you should be able to decode. So why can't, and I mean, you touched on there, you talked to Krajani and he voluntarily talking about lack of concentration. Surely that is something that shouldn't be charged at you level at a group of players if it's happening week after week. That's one thing they shouldn't lack for, concentration, because it's, right lads, today is the day we're going to be switched on and we're going to do what we need to do to keep that ball out of our net. But no, every game, it feels like, there's a vulnerability there. So, you know, I think that's probably where Yohannes is now visibly frustrated by it, because it's something for me that, from a coaching perspective, you should be able to eradicate or at least limit the multiples of goals they're conceding. It's an alarming number, and it really is, in the broader picture, checking any sense that they can get some forward momentum back into the season. And, you know, instead of feeling one step forward and maybe, you know, a bit of a treading water period where they're in now, they can actually get themselves attached again to that top six, top eight, and then we'll see what the end of the season brings. That's not going to happen if they are not able to keep the ball out of the back of the net at the other end and it not feel it's too good, hold your hands up, that was an excellent goal from the opposition, we couldn't do a lot about that, just individual or collective quality. That isn't the case at the moment, and that is why, you know, it's probably the most pressing issue Yohannes has, I would say, at the moment, along with his coaching staff.
Yeah, because it's taking so little for teams to take points against Norwich City and to score goals against Norwich City at the moment, compared to what it's taking Norwich City to create to score goals, and that is an imbalance that they need to address. Not to go all sort of like, you know, prehistoric and dinosaurs, but what I think should happen: concede from a set piece, £200 fine, all of you. Let's see how quickly they sorted it out. Then I think
no that, Christmas party. That should be.
Well, that would solve the concentration issue, wouldn't it? Yeah. Obviously,
no Christmas party next year.
I spoke to Yohannes before. It was his Christmas Eve press conference, I think, wasn't it? When he spoke in depth and he said about the vulnerability, and it was almost then, you know, it was at points we defend set pieces really well, and then we have one where for some reason, you know, whether it's just a concentration issue, people not doing their jobs effectively, it's really hard to put your finger on, because you look at like what they've done from attacking set pieces. I think they're a lot more effective at attacking set pieces now than they were earlier on in the season. You know, Duffy was very unlucky not to score from one today. It was a brilliant save onto the bar. Obviously, Cordoba scored one recently. There was another one as well, wasn't there, that I'm missing? So, or Slimani at Sunderland. So they have looked more effective in attacking them. It's just solving that there. And I think, like you say, if they do that, I think they will find themselves on the better end of results. Let's finish part one then. We haven't really discussed Millwall, but you can sort of, I think people who were there, you can go and read stuff and how that game unfolded. But 4 points over the festive period, Adam, to put this in, I don't know what exact golf terms, but if we're going for par, under par and over par, is that a thing?
Yes, it is a thing, okay.
Shows my level of, I'm beyond crazy golf, I'm useless. Where would you rank 4 points from these two home games?
I think under par, personally. I think they should have got 6 from these two games, given kind of their performances and the results prior, you know, the Sunderland defeat and the nature of that, the Burnley defeat and the nature of that. And I think kind of relative to the teams they were playing and their positions in the league, you know, we've spoken there about a lot of the issues that are still surrounding this squad. But at home, I think Norwich should be putting most teams to the sword, certainly teams like Millwall and QPR. So for me, yeah. Given the way they played today relative to the Millwall game where they were much better, disappointing that they haven't come away with 6.
Paddy?
Yeah, I concur with that. Yeah. Well, it's strictly in golf.
I know, we've got it wrong. I know.
You'd have to say they're over par. Yeah. Maybe plus one, plus two. With some challenging holes ahead over the rest of the festive period. But off the back of Burnley and Sunderland particularly, to only return 4 from 6 against two pretty average championship sides, with great respect to both of them. I think they'll feel a bit shortchanged. And you got that sense from Yohannes again today after his post-match that he would have known that was a game there for the taking today. And they didn't do enough to get the result and almost, you know, lost any result in the final analysis. So, yeah, it's hard to argue any other way for me. Yeah.
Yeah, I felt after Sunderland they needed to win these two. So yeah, I concur with you in saying what we over par, maybe not being what they should have got and what they could have got. I think it's still what 3 wins in 15 if my maths is correct. So that as a run isn't great. I do think, to caveat that, we could be speaking very differently about this point if they could go to Luton and get a win. That you know, if they could go and beat Cov, and suddenly you're looking at that block and it's 4 wins from five or 3 wins from four or whatever, then maybe this looks a better point in that context. But obviously, we clearly don't know what that context is going to be yet. So, yeah, I felt after Sunderland they needed to win both, and yeah, they haven't. So that piles a little bit more pressure onto this Luton game on New Year's Day. That probably does us for part one. Part two, we're going to be speaking about Czech wingers. We're going to be reflecting on the year that was 2024. And of course, we will be asking who was just the ticket for these two festive games. See you in a second. Welcome back to the final Pinken.com podcast of 2024, reflecting on a 1-1 draw against QPR, but also a festive period more generally. And I think we've done a little bit of that in part one. So part two, and with a new year, brings January, brings a transfer window, which probably lends us on to a little bit of discussion of where Norwich City are heading into this window. I think it's pretty well documented, Paddy, that Norwich City would like a right winger. Johannes Ovtorup has said they would like a defensive midfielder. Obviously, we're speaking pre-exit. Are there any other positions beyond that that you could really see Norwich entering? Obviously, pre anyone, you know, going, or there being any movement in any other areas?
Well, I think we're of the same mind that maybe the keeper situation. I think they'll look at that, because obviously with Angus, it's pretty clear now that you know that there isn't a sense those parties are on the same page in terms of what next. He's 6 months out from the end of his contract. Can speak to interested parties, of which there are. By all accounts, interested parties home and abroad. So, you know, in very short order, certainly by the summer, they're going to be looking for a number one. With the greatest respect to George Long, I don't think that's him. And you debate whether any of those academy level keepers, the Reyeses and Ansons and Archie Mayers, are good enough at this stage to step up as number one. So, do they look around in Jan and preempt that and try and bring somebody in the building who could maybe initially defer to Gunn, but then with a view to, you know, come the summer, come start next season, it's Norwich's number one. So I think that's an area, not, I wouldn't say that's a pressing priority. While Angus Gunn is still here, he's going to be Norwich's number one for the rest of this season. So, but the other two areas, absolutely, yeah. And yeah, and of course then you've got fluid situations around Hanley, where he was very clear, Johannes, that could translate into a club come in. He wants to go play regular football. They'd probably shake hands and wish him all the best. Ditto Ashley Barnes. Could that happen as well? The situation around Fashnak maybe muddied a little bit now with his hamstring issue. It's going to keep him out for most of this coming month now. Will that scupper a deal potentially back to Switzerland? Kate Gordon, that feels like it's going to have to resolve itself in him departing and going back to Liverpool. So all of those strands may have knock-on effects. Of course, we've not even got into a Borja Sainz scenario, have we? You know, the clubs that will be stockpiling up to be linked with him, whether any of them actually show their hand.
Well, we had a very bizarre situation this week where Besiktas let everyone know they weren't interested, and I'm not sure they've even been linked. So that was an
good,
odd episode.
Good to put that out there, though. Yeah.
So if any other clubs aren't interested, then yeah, make yourself known.
Yeah, that thins the field out a little bit. Could be quite hectic though if every club. But so I think the priority clearly in the here and now is maybe right side of the three and the DM. Yeah, and on the right side, it's no secret now that they're clearly having a concerted look at the boy from Slavia Prague, Matej Juracek.
Yeah, and we'll come back onto him in a moment and speak about him in a bit more depth. But Adam, I think in terms of where Norwich are at, and I think for some of the reasons that we've discussed in part one, I mean, I feel, and I wrote about this today in my column, that you know, we speak about depth, and I think that's maybe less of a quality point at times. There clearly is a degree of that sort of wider outside maybe the frontline 20. But you think about players, you know, and I'm probably very harsh in labelling these three because there are others, but you think Jack Stacey, Onan Hernandez, Ashley Barnes, and probably the latter two were key in the goal that Norwich City scored this afternoon. But more generally, dropping those guys into a tore-up style, they were very effective in Jack Stacey in particular, Ashley Barnes in particular, in terms of what David Wagner wanted to do, but just don't feel like they necessarily fit a possession-based style from maybe the off. They do in certain situations, in certain games, absolutely, and you need variation, but it feels like they probably need more profile of tore-up player, and that's probably why this window feels quite important from that perspective.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, today, like, obviously, the fact you had more Condes you could throw on, he felt more like he could go onto that midfield and impact things in the same manner that any of the other three in the midfield were capable of doing in the first half. So, yeah, for those reasons, yeah, I'd agree with you. I think in terms of profile, it's obviously going to be a slow process now, getting up to a point where Norwich have a squad where it's, on the whole, good enough from a depth point of view, where they can throw pretty much anyone on in any position and they have a similar profile of player that can impact it. But that's where they've got to strive to get to. And obviously, this is the first window now after the summer that they've got to try and address that, which is why I feel that, you know, any point in terms of, you know, I've seen it a few times again today, views on Torup and, you know, his sort of reign, I suppose, as Norwich manager still at the moment, just needs to be put under the carpet for the time being. Because you can't judge this at any point for me this season. It's all about next season. You know, they then have another summer window, and okay, there's going to be an element of time again for these players that they bring in the summer to adapt and transition. But you'd hope that this, you know, January cohort that hopefully they bring a few more in will be up to speed by the time you reach the summer. You've obviously got the ones they brought in last summer that will be a little bit more up to speed. So I think gradually you will start to see this progress and this Hofball that we're seeing elements of, hopefully will be a more sustainable brand of football for the course of a season and games for full 90 minutes rather than 45 minutes. But I think, you know, it's pretty evident when you're substituting off the likes of Siennats for Ashley Barnes, they're completely different players. And unfortunately, it was, you know, as you mentioned, yeah, okay, Barnes provided the touch for Onel, who put it back across for Nunez. But on the whole, they just don't suit what he's trying to do. Barnes is not someone who's going to go and press your defenders for 90 minutes. And okay, he's got a little bit more of the physicality, maybe more than Siennats, but probably not that stamina level, and certainly not a player that's capable of getting in behind, you know, in the same manner that Siennats can. So yeah, it's just going to be a time element with all of it, but this is another opportunity to put those building blocks in place ahead of next season.
Yeah, and it's not to say that those players don't have quality either, because clearly we've seen over a season the quality that Jack Stacey has in a system where his direct running is perhaps better utilised and better extracted. Ashley Barnes, likewise, we've seen flashes of what he was able to do alongside Josh Sargent for periods of that, but Norwich play with one up front, that's not something that really suits him anyway, let alone maybe the style of play that they want to. And it's quite telling that probably Onel Hernandez is being brought on ahead of him, and there are other examples. And it just feels like a little bit of a... Of a mismatch, I guess, in terms of the squad that they've got at the moment, where you've got players from different eras recruited for different things, and you throw that all into a pot, and it just feels a little bit jumbled, and that's probably contributing maybe to this lack of consistency that we're seeing. Mateja Jurasek, let's speak about him, winger at Slavia Prague, fits in terms of age profile. I think, you know, we've reported clearly someone that they are interested in. Not somebody who at any time soon we're going to see in Norwich for any talks or anything like that.
Well, he's not arrived yet.
No.
So, whether he subsequently does, who knows. But, yeah, just go back to the initial soundings we've had there that do Norwich like that player very much. Done a lot of recruitment work on him. He's been sifted through their machine of analysts and data experts, and because as we know, I mean, we sat down with Lee Dunn relatively recently this season, and the kind of case study he mapped out with Callum Doyle, these are painstaking processes. They don't just work on the hoof and a month before January they start to decide, oh, who do we fancy signing then, lads? No, this player, this profile of player is the process of a very thorough forensic piece of recruitment work. So yes, they like the player. But, and you can see previously, he's at the best club in Czechia. It changed, didn't it? It was Czech Republic, and it's on you.
I'm not getting involved. You do.
AH is the travel expert. What's the correct pronunciation?
Czech Republic, I believe. Yeah.
I thought they were Czechia these days.
I don't know. Yeah. When I went, it was that. But
okay, well, yeah. So Czech league, anyway. He's playing for the best club. I think they're six, seven, 8 points clear, aren't they? Yeah. Playing in European competition, high caliber player, prospect, but under a long contract. I think he's 27, if not 28. He's under contract till. So that's where the complexity in a deal of this nature would come in, because if you're Slavia, it's not a situation we've got to sell him because he's running his contract down, and the bargaining power is with the player and maybe a buying club. So there's a willingness from Norwich to do that deal. They're still talking about that, and until they probably club to club reach any semblance of a structure that would lead to a roadmap to doing that deal, I don't think we'll be seeing Jurisic actually in Norwich with his representatives. That isn't to say that that could happen, and that could accelerate very quickly. You know, we're on the cusp of the window opening now. Norwich will be mindful that, you know, has been linked to some big clubs in the past, and I'm sure those clubs and others will still have him on their recruitment radar. So, you know, maybe it's a sense of if Norwich can move swiftly and almost beat others to the punch, something could happen. I think there's a feeling they could get to the figures that Slavia would want. I mean, there was reports of €6 to 8 million. I think it'd be maybe slightly lower than that. But by all accounts, Norwich could get to the lower end of that scale. So I don't think that would be the reason this deal wouldn't happen. It's probably just the case now of, first and foremost, an agreement with his club, and then convincing the player. And obviously, to do that, part of that would be getting him over to Colney, showing him the facilities, sitting down with Johannes, primarily Ben Napa as well, as they've done previously, you know, with lots of Doyle, with lots of Adoba. And I would imagine if you could get the player and his representatives to Norfolk and you showed him around Colney, aside from the financials around the deal makes sense, both from the player's point of view and his club, I think there's a deal that can be done there. Because why do I think that? Because the amount of legwork Norwich have put in, you don't commit to this amount of work and get to this far in the process if you don't think there's a deal to be done there and that the player could be enticed to Norwich. So we'll see how it develops. These things can fall down. Most notably, you only go back to last summer and the Yildirim deal. Mm-hmm. You know, that again, the same amounts of recruitment, painstaking homework would have been done to get that deal to that point, and then that falls down maybe at the, as it was reported, at the medical stage. So nothing's a given when it comes to these transfers. But is he a player they like? Yes. Is he a player they're trying to make a deal for? Yes. But as of Sunday evening, he has not boarded a plane for Prague heading towards Norwich.
And I don't think you need to watch Flight Radar too heavily in this January for reasons explained in the summer window. But yeah, he's an interesting one, Adam, isn't he, in terms of his age profile, plays European football, good amount of domestic minutes, but there's some quotes from his agent in around Christmas about them looking to get him out in January, essentially. So there's clearly a willingness on his part to go and play football. I had a little bit of a look into him, and I think he's played 91 games for Slavia Prague, but only started 31. He's not started that many this season. Clearly somebody who has impressed when he has played. So you can see all of those boxes sort of ticking what Norwich City want. Only 21, clearly a lot of development in there. If you can get him into a style like Norwich is, and he's a right-sided player, left-footed, so cutting in, you could see the attraction on sort of all of those fronts.
Yeah, I did see a little bit of a highlights reel, which obviously I'm a little bit remiss.
You've not been YouTubing him.
Not YouTubing, it was actually on one of my other social feeds, and I did have a little bit of a look. He sort of reminds me a little bit of signs, some of the goals they were showing, him cutting in, corner, curling shot. So clearly that's a player that would tick a box in terms of what Norwich have done previously and what they're probably trying to do moving forwards. And given obviously we know that, you know, the situation with Sainz probably going to be departing, and you know, you look at the sort of other options they have in the building, you know, Fashnak's not that kind of player, Kay Gordon clearly not of the quality that they feel could impact it at the moment. On Els, obviously they've trialled him more sort of through the middle, and obviously we know that his situation, he's out of contract as well. So there's a few kind of plates there to be spun, but this feels like, yeah, as you mentioned, the age of him, the sort of player that he is, obviously stamina and ability to press will obviously be, you'd think, of a level that he'd be good enough, and playing in a team that's played in Europe, you know, and obviously in European competitions, you know, I think the Czech league's obviously not of the greatest standard probably, you know, whether it's kind of translatable to the Championship. We'll, you know, time will tell if he arrives and how he gets on. But yeah, I think it's an exciting one, and you know, obviously a little bit more of the unknown again, which I quite like. You know, I know sort of Norwich have had some successes, obviously, if you look at kind of across the previous summer, and some that just haven't quite worked out at the moment. But yeah, I think with time, again, that'll be another kind of caveat they'll add on to this signing. It'll be another one that will need a little bit of time to adapt again, get up to speed, and don't judge him too harshly straight away. But yeah, hopefully he can come and impact it, because clearly it's a position, that sort of right side, that Norwich have struggled a little bit at the moment, and it's something they need to address, and he would probably tick most of the boxes.
Yeah, watch this space on that one, as Paddy said, and as we know, until everything's signed, done and announced, these things are never done until they're done. So let's see how it all unfolds. But clearly a very interesting player from an Norwich City perspective. Right, let's wrap up the pod with a little bit of reflection on 2024, which has been, I mean, Norwich have packed a lot into it. Playoff run, first and foremost, East Anglian derby win to extend the run to 15 years. A head coach change, an ownership change, although that's technically not quite done. Clearly, it was in 2023 we had the sporting director change, but new idea, new strategy, new approach, lots of new players. It's been a frantic one, Paddy.
Yeah, when you map it out like that, it's not been dull, that's for sure. But that's good, because I think when we've discussed this at length previously, you know, the sense that they were almost that end of an era kind of tiredness around the place. Yeah. And not a lot of optimism, kind of not going through the motions, but a club that were on maybe, footballing wise, maybe a bit of a downward spiral. But that clearly, you know, you changed the sporting director at the start of the year, which is towards the end of last year. Then you actually make that head coach change, and who you bring in, the profile of head coach you bring in, massive statement there to bring in a head coach like Torup, and with, you know, with his age profile and his brand of football that he brings from Denmark. And you know, obviously we've had a bit more clarity now at boardroom level. That's important as well, because that's where the tone is set, and it's very clear. I know there's still you know, this rubber stamping process procedurally, but to all intents and purposes, it's Mark Attanasio, it's Norfolk Holdings now, who were holding the, you know, the hands on the tiller, as it were. So, yeah, it probably will look back, and 24 was almost a repositioning, realignment period for the club on and off the park. And you just hope that the individuals now in place, and the vision that they've got and the strategy they've got, that they can just now carry on as we move into 25 and deliver on that. And then the tangible end product is seen on the pitch, and is hopefully seen in terms of an elevated league status, because that would then be really exciting, because then it'd be almost back to where Farker and Weber and that era got them to. But then it's, can they break that glass ceiling? That's the challenge. But before you even get to that point, they need to get themselves back to the Premier League. So yeah, for me, if we were on this discussion this time 12 months ago, I think the optimism levels would be drastically reduced to what they are now, to put it mildly. Because really, it was only Josh Sargent, if you remember, coming back in against Southampton, wasn't it, New Year's Day, after that 4 months out injured, that subsequently really ticked the season back up again from a position where it was looking pretty bleak. So certainly, yeah, this time last year, there was no sense of a club moving forward again and trying to be bold and innovative and ahead of the curve. The problem is, and Norwich have played a few of those clubs recently, I'm thinking of the Sunderlands of this world, you know, other clubs in the Championship are trying to do the same thing or very similar. So there's no guarantees that this comes off, and that Attanasio and Napa and Torup, almost that triumvirate, drive this club forward to where they hope they want to take it. But it feels like they're in with a chance now, and it feels like, talking on the last segment about transfer windows, we saw evidence of that last summer with the type of player they've gone for, you know, what they're trying to do mid to longer term, how they're trying to reconnect the academy as well. All of that takes time, it needs patience, and we'll see more evidence of that this January, we'll see more evidence in the summer. But if there can be some tangible steps forward taken on the pitch between now and May, then I think they're really geared up to have a really good go next season, and that could be a very exciting season if you're an Norwich fan.
Yeah, I'm going to ask the gents in a minute, and this is more for their purposes than for yours. But I'm going to ask them for their high and low point of 2024 in just a moment. But I think what you say there is a reason why, just to sort of bring this back to maybe where we are at the moment and this season. I think a lot of the comparisons and almost it feels like Norwich haven't been helped by finishing in the playoffs last season, because that's almost a that almost gets used as the measuring stick to mark their progress in the here and now. And it's like, well, they finished sixth last season, so they've got to match that or better that. And I think you've almost got to completely detach last season to where they are now, because it's a completely different thing, completely different people, completely different strategy, completely different universe, really, to where they were last year, where it was about getting promoted. And sixth was probably about par for where they were with that squad. This year is very different because they're trying to do a lot of different things, and it's almost a season where they're setting the ground to go and then have a campaign where you can spring off. So I think that's maybe a sort of footnote that I wanted to mention. But yeah, Adam, it's let's go on to it then. Let's start with I'll let you decide. Would you want to start with high points or low points?
Let's start with the low points so we can get to the high points.
Okay, I like that. Give us your low point of 2024.
I think it's hard to escape that Elland Road kind of feeling. I think we all knew going into that playoff campaign that it felt unlikely that Norwich were going to come out of it with a trip to Wembley and promotion back to the Premier League. And I think sitting here now as well, that could have been the worst possible outcome had they've got there, because, you know, there was clearly a feeling internally that David Wagner wasn't the man to lead it forward anyway. And had they've gone to the Premier League with that squad, and also then kind of, I suppose, the eyes of the world completely on you as well, this sort of period of transition or in at the moment would have been even more difficult. But yeah, just that feeling. I think the manner they lost it, had they lost it, you know, by the 1-2 goal margin, and they played relatively well and it was, you know, a little bit unlucky, then I think you could have accepted it and just said, yep, we were beaten by the better team on the day. But the way they just capitulated and fell apart, wasn't the most pleasant of feelings.
Low point, Paddy?
Well, yeah, I'll be more specific. It was full-time Elland Road, second leg. Capitulation, sat there having to listen to Marching On Together from about 40.
I thought you were going to say I predict a riot. I can't listen to that song now.
No, I think that came afterwards, yeah. But no, and they were all there waving their white scarves, you know, Farker taking his leave as well. So yeah, it was a joyful position to be in from a Norwich perspective. But yeah, you can't, I don't think anything was because even after that first leg they were still in that tie, you know, albeit, you know, Leeds were the favourites, but the way they just threw it in was probably symptomatic of the malaise that had culminated with what happened in the summer. In the summer, about 24 hours after the final whistle, he was less than that. It was more like about 12 hours after the final whistle, David was departed, and in short order, Johannes was in the building. So, yeah, I struggled to find any point that felt as low as that.
Yeah, I agree. I will go two games at the start of the year, just but I do agree that was the low point. But Southampton at home, which even though they got a point from, was absolutely soul destroying to watch an Norwich team have 25% possession and play in the manner they did. And okay, maybe the end did justify the means, but it's just not the way I want to watch a Norwich team go about football or approach football. And it's even more sort of depressing now you look at what Southampton maybe haven't done in the Premier League under Russell Martin. You realise where the golf is, but yeah, just a million miles away from I think what I'd want an Norwich City team to be. So that was quite bleak. And then the Bristol Rovers away replay, not for any footballing reason, but we were in the minus that night. I remember walking around the pitch post match, and by the time I got to the other side of the pitch and put my foot on the ground, it had frozen. It was so cold.
It's minus six.
Yeah. They scraped through, and to be fair, I did set up a fourth round tie at Anfield. But yeah, maybe the first third round game was more depressing. But I think if you'd have asked me on that 90 minutes, would you scrap FA Cup replays? I'd have said yes. But clearly, in the bigger picture, it's an issue. So those are a couple of others to throw into the mix. I'm sure you guys maybe have some others to throw in there as well. And high point, I suspect there's probably only one answer to this, but Mr. Davitt.
Derby day,
yeah,
yeah, absolutely, yeah. Purely because
it's quite funny, isn't it?
Funny in the sense of if ever they were going to have an opportunity. I mean, to be fair, their opportunity was Portman Road earlier in the season, but even allowing for that, Norwich getting out of dodge with a draw that day, John Rowe. at that point where they really trucking on, and give them their due. We have to, you know, McKenna did a fantastic job to get that group of players out there, as they're proving now, conversely, in the Premier League, overachieved with that group. And Norwich, yes, okay, they were in that hovering top six position and eventually secured it, but still, they were so on the day. I mean, I know it was, you know, probably an error from the keeper from that Nunez free kick that settled it, but just in general play, you just watched them and thought, well, how is this team doing what they're doing and scoring the amount of goals and playing the brand of football? They just looked so inhibited, weighed down by 15 years of East Anglian history, and it was a joy to see, to be honest, because you did fear that was probably going to be the day they pitched up and ended the pain, but you know, it wasn't to be. I'm trying to think what that Suffolk radio commentator's infamous comment was, you know, when...
Oh no, how awful.
Could have given that an earring, yeah, in that particular game, yeah. So that was, has to be a high point, doesn't it? Because it was, in contrast to a lot of the previous 15 years of meetings when the teams have met, and Norwich, let's be honest, most neutrals would say were the better club, the better team, probably in a higher league status and probably were favourites to win these games. I don't think that was definitely not the case in those two games. And for them to maintain their hex was very satisfying.
It's been interesting to see them maybe wake up to the reality of the Premier League, and that it's not...
They've only spent £100 million.
I know. How can you be competitive with that? It's not a fun place to be. I think they're maybe realising just quite how difficult it is. I know that probably is the high point, Adam, but any others that really stand out to you?
Yeah, that is definitely the high point. I think Derby away, actually, this year was mm-hmm. a high point for me. I think, you know, given that Norwich went there and there's a lot of statistics and metrics around Derby's home form, I think they'd been unbeaten in 10 games, stretching back to sort of February time, and quite enjoyable watching their fan base in front of us in absolute rage at the manner of the first goal.
Us, I think, as well.
To come away from that place with the win they did, in the manner they did, obviously, you know, the fact that they were kind of under the pressure cooker a bit at 1-1, and it felt like, you know, they might cave under a little bit, as we've kind of spoken around a little bit in this sort of podcast in recent performances. But then to you know, hit them in the way they did and make it 3-1, then 3-2, and just to hold on to that win in front of, what was it, like 3,000 Norwich fans that day. Yeah, I think that, for me, as a template for what this team could potentially do in the future away from home, which is, we've not seen too many wins on the road this season, does breed a little bit of confidence, I suppose, moving forward.
Yeah, I think you guys have picked some good ones there. Definitely that.
I mean, I was thinking some of Sara's stunners. Yep. Some of those goals, yep. You know, I can't put off the top of my head. Remember all the games.
Oh, the Rotherham,
yeah, that was the peach, wasn't it? Yeah. So, I mean, they'd be good highlights.
Yeah. You get a good highlight reel with him and Science, wouldn't you, from 2024, all their strikes. Right, let's end the pod then. Just the ticket. Obviously, it's a segment brought to you by First Bus, our sponsors, and we're very grateful to have them on board, and you guys are all very grateful to be on board of the First Buses. So we've got two games to pick from, so I think that widens the field a little bit. Adam, who are you going to go for? Who's just the ticket for you over these two games?
I'm going to go with Slimani. I think he's... I'd almost include the Sunderland performance as well in that. I think he's slowly starting to build himself into quite a key figure in that Norwich midfield. Seems very comfortable in tight spaces, good on the ball. First touch is always pretty decent. Striving forwards, always sort of looking to try and push Norwich up the pitch rather than sort of regress them backwards. I think if he can just keep his fitness levels, and he slowly feels like he's starting to build that a bit, because, you know, before, maybe in those earlier games in the season, we saw the flashes of quality, but then he couldn't sustain it for more than maybe 30 minutes before he looked like he was sort of ready to come off the pitch. Now it feels like he's kind of up to the 60-70 minute mark, and hopefully, you know, moving forwards, if he can keep himself in the team, and as these games keep coming thick and fast, he gets a little bit of a rest, hopefully he can sort of kick on a little bit more maybe in the second half of the season, and given the kind of option Norwich have on him, he feels like it could be a good bit of business to do next summer.
Yeah, agreed. 1.4 million, that is. Yeah, I think even if as a sort of squad option, I think he's someone that you would take at that price, irrespective maybe of how the season unfolds from here. I'm going to go for Oscar Schwartau as my one, mainly for the Millwall game rather than today, I'll be honest. But his goal, he became the youngest non-British player to score a goal for Norwich City in the club's history, which is a nice stat, overtaking Adam Eder in that, and his three goals at Preston on that day. He got that hat trick, but I think of the what has been a problematic right side, which hopefully for the reasons we've discussed around January might be solved a little bit. I think he's probably been the best one in that area of the pitch. Doesn't really look like an 18-year-old. I think his rate of progress has been really impressive since he first joined the club, and people were talking about him as an option for season two or even season three of this project, how quickly he's sort of come to the fore and looked at home. I think he's a very impressive player. I like how he glides. Even today, I didn't think he was the most involved, but some of those diagonal balls, the way he takes them on his chest, his first touch, I think there's a really good base there. And I've just got a feeling that at some point he is going to explode in terms of goals and assists. And I think Norwich City are going to have a real asset on their hands. I don't know when that will be. And, you know, it could be in 3 years' time when he's 21. But I've just got a feeling at some point he's going to go. And we'll see the real best of him. I'm still excited to see him probably centrally long term, because I think that's where Norwich will really get the best out of his creativity. But I think we've seen maybe flashes of his potential over this festive period. So yeah, Oscar Schwartel for me. Paddy Davitt.
Yeah, no, Callum Doyle I'm going to go for. I mean, you talked on diagonal balls, he's been the source of a lot of those in these last two games, and in fact Schwartel's goal against Millwall was a Doyle diagonal, and again this afternoon his passing is so crisp, so sharp, so accurate, long and short. That natural balance. There was one instance in the first half where he just let it run across his body, and in one movement he's like swept it out to Kurzemi, I think it was. It just opens up the pitch and does it instantly. You know, it's not take it in, I have to move it, I have to shift my body position and get it out of my feet. There's no doubt now. Centre back is where he needs to play. Obviously, Yanis has a dilemma now with Cordoba.
I think we'll see about left back on Wednesday.
Well, exactly, that's the problem, yeah. But his effectiveness is off the dial at centre-back, where he can step in. He's got the centre of the pitch, he's got the full picture of the pitch, and he's got the passing range that he can connect those wider players. But I think, yeah, I wouldn't be at all surprised if, you know, he looks at Luton, looks at Morris and Adebayo, and he wants Duffy and Cordoba in there, almost Portsmouth-esque in that sense. And if that is the case, it will be Doyle. So I don't think that's the best position for him now, but you know, having gone through a bit of a fallow period, I think it's fair to say before Christmas, having been excellent at the start of the season, it's good to see him back in the groove, in a position I feel he's better suited to, where he can, which is his strongest suit, is work on the ball. Defensively, he's solid enough in the centre of the back four. Doesn't get exposed for his lack of pace, relatively, against the better operators at this level. But yeah, it would be a shame if he got shifted. I wouldn't be surprised if he got shifted. But for me, I think these two home games, he's shown his quality on the ball. And that is such a key attribute to how Forop likes to progress the ball in those deeper build-up phases.
I think I'll be asking or knocking on Manchester City's door in the summer and just see if there's any prospect. There may not be, but I think
he's... It'd be a steep old fee, though, wouldn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I think it would be. I think it would be, unfortunately. But I think you'd ask the question, wouldn't you? So, yeah, that seems like a nice place to leave it for this podcast and for this year. 2025 starts for us in Luton at Kenilworth Road, which I'm sure you all agree is a fabulous way to start a new year, a ground that Norwich City historically don't do very well at all. But hopefully they can break that trend and start the year in a good fashion. And yeah, we're talking about a very, very positive 2025 from a Norwich City perspective. But that leaves us to say Happy New Year to you all. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. The podcasts over 2024 will be back with the same old nonsense, the same old people speaking nonsense over the next 12 months. And we very much look forward to you guys joining us for those conversations. See you soon.